You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
On April 20th, the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, killing 11 crew members. 2 days later, the rig, leased by oil giant British Petroleum, collapsed into the Gulf and oil began leaking. It has been leaking at an estimated 200,000 gallons every day since. That could potentially increase to 2.5 million gallons a day if attempts to curb the leak continue to fail. Antonia Juhas is author of The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. And she's joined me by phone this morning to discuss the BP oil spill. Good morning, Antonia.
Good morning.
How deep was this rig drilling in the Gulf when it exploded?
Well, it was drilling at 18,000 feet below the ocean surface. To put that in context, in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico, most platforms exist at drill lengths 30 feet, 120 feet. A deep well is 1,000 feet below the ocean surface. An ultra-deep well is 5,000 feet below. And this rig was drilling at 18,000 feet below the ocean surface. And BP actually drilled the deepest well in history anywhere in the world in the U.S. Gulf, and that's 25,000 feet below the ocean surface. That's almost as far down below the ocean surface as Mount Everest is up.
That's absolutely incredible when you think of that kind of comparison. You think of Everest and you think of it that far below the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how dangerous is it to drill to such depths?
Well, we don't know. There has not been that much of it done before. What we do know is what we've just seen. There is a lot of offshore drilling and has been a lot of offshore drilling going on in the world. It's a new phenomenon in the last 10 years to push into these ultra, ultra, ultra deep areas. And it's happened for two reasons. The first is that the oil companies are more desperate for oil. In about 2004, there was an estimation done by the U.S. federal government that the major oil companies, BP, Exxon, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, that they would be out of their own oil in about 10 years. And so there was a big push to try and acquire more oil, get it from governments that already have it, because it's governments that own most of the world's oil. So that would, in my book, be things like wars in Iraq, and to a slightly lesser extent, Afghanistan, and to push the technological horizon and open up new frontiers and use new technology. So that's areas like really aggressively going into the Alberta tar sands, really aggressively going into shale production, and then deeper offshore. So this is new technology. Then the other side of it was that the oil industry under the Bush administration, that the global oil industry, which was affected by Bush administration policies, dramatically increased its wealth. So they became, in the last the 8 years of the Bush administration, just simply the wealthiest industry the world has literally ever known. There is no financial comparison to the wealth that this industry holds. So they had the cash to go further. And so we've got companies like BP in particular, but not alone there, that has really pushed the envelope for what is technologically feasible. And how we know that is that this rig exploded, and how we know that it's not technologically feasible is because there is no way that we have ever used before to fix this problem, because no one's ever tried to. So the cap that they're trying to put on this spill to hold it in is a cap that's only ever been successfully used at water depths of 500 feet. This is 18,000 feet. And we just don't know essentially what the ramifications are going to be, because nothing like this has ever happened.
So when you read that if they had spent more money and put this kind of valve or that kind of valve, then it would have been safe, then really we're just in the area of conjecture in terms of that.
It would have been better. U.S. regulation is far too lax because of the cozy relationship to the oil industry. So there was safety redundancies that should have been in place that are required in other countries that aren't required here that could have potentially stopped the explosion. There was BP was given allowed to not fulfill a full environmental review for this project. It was given a pass, essentially, by the Obama administration for that. There are things that could have made this safer and can make it safer. There is nothing that can make it safe.
How much money does the oil industry spend on lobbying?
The BP alone spent $16 million lobbying just the U.S. federal government last year. That made it one of the top 20 spenders. The oil industry itself spends tens of millions in combined annual dollars, and that amount has been increasing significantly as the industry got more wealthy, but also when the Bush administration left and the oil industry lost basically its inside route inside the government, it then started lobbying. And so in 2008 and 2009, the lobbying expenditures increased significantly. And what that has done is essentially continued what began inside the Bush administration, which was lax regulatory oversight combined with a permission to essentially go anywhere in the drilling. And so we've actually seen an immense increase in United States oil production in the last 8 years because of the Bush administration, so much so that we have an oil glut. We're actually exporting out more oil than we ever have before, and we are consuming less gasoline, and oil companies are shutting down refineries in the United States at the same time as there's these calls for more production, which essentially at this time we just don't need.
So under the Bush administration, there wasn't a need to lobby, and under Obama's administration, there is. I don't know how we would define need, but they see a need to lobby. But it's being successful, I guess, if we look at the lifting of the moratorium in Alaska.
The moratorium was actually a moratorium on all offshore drilling in the United States, except for in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico, and except for some rigs that were already operating. And it was the Bush administration that eliminated the moratorium. It was the Obama administration that implemented the lifting of the moratorium by opening up new areas of drilling off the Atlantic coast. The good news is that the Obama administration has halted those new leases and said that it will wait to see what the investigation of this blowout shows. Hopefully, it will be enough to keep those waters from being opened up. We already experienced in the United States best of environmental laws, environmental movement actually stem from a 1969 blowout of a Chevron rig off the coast of California that opened people's eyes to a lack of regulation, a lack of oversight over the industry, and led to the creation of our environmental agencies and some of our best environmental laws. Hopefully, the upside of this tragedy will be a new resurgence of attention in the United States to regulating this industry.
Is this the first major accident involving BP?
Not at all, and certainly not in the world, but in the United States, the last great major workplace incident in the United States was a BP refinery that blew up, and the finding was that the cause of the explosion was that BP had been doing such aggressive cost-cutting and paying not enough attention to safety and oversight and training of its workers, that an accident was destined to happen, and it did. And so, unfortunately, it wasn't a surprise when the next great big oil industry disaster that struck in the United States was also a BP disaster. But that said, BP is certainly not alone in the boundaries that it's pushing and the lack of regulatory oversight that's being exercised over its operations.
Now, BP promotes itself as an innovator in developing alternative energy. Is there anything to that claim?
Well, the whole industry portrays itself as investing in alternative energy, and that's because we like to hear it, and it makes us think of them in warm, fuzzy ways. The truth is that at very best, BP spent at very best, at the height of its expenditures in 2006, which have gone down since then, on alternative energy, a total of 4% of its capital and exploratory budget on a very, very generous category of what could be considered green energy. and 4% was the best. It's since gone down. So that's real money. It's a big company. 4% of its money does buy it solar power. It does buy it wind. But it's hardly enough to qualify the company as beyond petroleum when everything else it does is oil and natural gas. And BP actually is the best in the industry at 4%. So most companies spend 3%, 2%. In the case of Exxon, nothing until recently. They actually used to boast about the fact that they didn't invest in alternative energy at all, and then that won them a few too many enemies. And the industry does this basically so that we won't regulate them. We will think of them as companies that are moving into green energy and therefore don't need as much of our attention. And what we have to do is essentially sort of wipe away that hype and look to the core of the business that these companies are in, and it is a deeply committed business of oil. And some companies like Chevron also do coal, but basically they're fossil fuel industries. They're not alternative energy industries.
Now, I understand that there is a proposal that should be concerning us off the coast of Canada. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, Chevron, which is the company that I pay the most attention to because it is one of the most deeply flawed and dangerous oil companies out there from its history of operations and current operations, is also a leader in offshore drilling. And Chevron is just about to start on about 6,500 feet below the ocean surface, 2.6 kilometers. New offshore drilling operations off the coast of Newfoundland. And this is brand new. It's happening at the same time, by the way, as in Alaska, where Chevron is fighting with regulators because it wants to continue to use a 40-year-old corroded oil pipe to carry its offshore operations from the offshore Alaska to the shore. They want to make sure that they can continue to use a heavily, heavily, heavily corroded pipe to carry that oil. Now they're proposing a new rig, an ultra-deep shore rig off the coast of Newfoundland.
So that's that rig is in the area where we just simply don't know enough to make it safe, in your opinion?
In my opinion, there has certainly been drilling at 6,000 feet for a while. 6,000 feet isn't 18,000 feet. But my opinion is that offshore drilling, everything that we know about it, and even in the words of a Chevron executive, it's very expensive, it's very dangerous, and it's a total crapshoot. It's only about 2 out of 10 holes yield oil. Drilling at depths of 500 feet or more releases methane, a greenhouse gas, 25 times more destructive to the climate than CO2. It releases, even when it's operating correctly, the drilling releases toxins, pollution, severely harms marine species. And then there are the miles and miles of pipeline that have to carry the oil to the shore. And these often are the cause of accidents, spills, blowouts. And then there are the chances of accidents. And the technology simply has not been created to ensure that these rigs won't have accidents and won't be dangerous. And when they do, the other thing about oil is it's toxic, and we don't have any real way to fully get it out of the water. When it goes into the water, it stays in the water. It seeps into groundwater. It goes into the air. It's a toxic substance that you don't want anywhere near you. And so from my perspective, we do not need to be doing this type of drilling. We shouldn't be having new offshore drilling taking place, and we need to figure out how to make do essentially with the oil that we've got until we can transition away from it altogether.
Now, as you said earlier, that when there was a major accident several decades ago, this brought in some new legislation, good environmental protection. How do you think we can use this opportunity now of this disaster to really push for some kind of change?
Well, we are, and I think the good news is that there has been a public response, and there are a tremendous amount of organizing that's going on, and most importantly, organizing that's going on in the communities most affected. So work that I'm involved in is bringing communities that are affected by Chevron's operations all around the world whether it's offshore operations, whether it's operations in the Gulf of Mexico or in Ecuador or in Alaska or in Canada, to come together, raise their voices, and talk about how we can resist this industry from the inside, but then more importantly, demonstrate that not only are there harms caused by this industry, but there is resistance, and that if more people will join with us and advocate for lasting policy change, we can actually counter the money of the industry through our mass numbers. And we can say to our elected officials, these are one of the issues on which we will or will not allow you to serve in office. And these are the issues on which we will hold you to account. And if we can say that with enough commitment and bring in enough of our allies to do that, I really think we can create change, and hopefully this is a teachable, learnable moment that will galvanize more people to take that extra step, which is a political step, and to say, we will demand more change of our policymakers.
Thank you so much for talking to us this morning, Antonia.
Well, thank you for having me.
I've been talking with Antonia Juhas. She is the author of The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. And she's also director of the Chevron Program at Global Exchange.